Can I point out that a lot of people might think it's not tacky, degustibus, right? Like, I mean, you know, people might not like your murder parasite house from which you taped the podcast, but, like, some people might like it.
Hello and welcome to this late night reaction edition of the 538 Politics podcast. I'm Galen Druk. We've just wrapped up the fourth and final night of the Republican National Convention, capping off 2 weeks of conventions. We did it. I'm sure everyone is tired. We'll try to keep it short tonight. President Trump formally accepted the party's renomination for president. It was a prepared 5,680 words long, making it the second longest convention speech by an incumbent since World War II. It was a wide-ranging speech touching on lots of different policies, which we can get into. It was also preceded by a speech from Ivanka Trump, his daughter, of course, aimed at softening the president's image. So let's discuss it all. Here with me to do that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. Hey, Nate.
Wait, they're related? Ivanka and Donald?
I know. I just wanted to like make sure that I clarified who exactly Ivanka Trump was.
I believe her real name is Ivana, but Ivanka is a diminutive.
Wait, really?
Fun fact. Dropping some knowledge.
I didn't know that. Isn't her mom's name Ivana?
Correct.
Oh, so she's...
The first two children are named for the parents.
I like that name, Ivana.
Interesting.
Well, you can name a child that.
As you've heard, senior politics writer Claire Malone is also with us. Hey, Claire.
Hi, Galen.
And managing editor Micah Cohen. Hey, Micah.
Hey, Galen.
So we are going to have, of course, a podcast out this coming Monday, and we can review some more of what happened at the conventions and whether or not we've seen any movement in the polls since. So we'll try to keep things kind of concise this evening. But I just want to hear, as I mentioned, it was a very long speech, touched on a lot of different things. What were your general takeaways from the evening? Micah, kick us off.
I think my takeaway is that these conventions will go down as being largely not influential on the campaign and not one of the more kind of memorable convention sets in election history, modern campaign history. Nothing particularly stood out in either convention, and I would include Trump's speech tonight. It actually was a fairly boilerplate, lots of people were saying, and I agree, kind of State of the Union-y speech. Like a State of the Union speech, I think in terms of policies, but also in terms of lines of attack on Biden, you saw just the Trump campaign throwing a lot against the wall. It was kind of all over the place. So for someone like me who's mostly interested in like, okay, what can we learn from this about the party and about how the Trump campaign is going to pursue the rest of the campaign? I don't know. I came away pretty confused.
I want better writing for the American people. Policies aside, which I'm sure we'll talk about. It was just a terribly written speech. I think calling it like a State of the Union speech is even giving it too much credit. It's hard to write long. You need structure. The piece had no structure. There were no core thematic elements. It was not engaging. It was not engagingly delivered. It was a poor ending to a fine, otherwise like fine night of television. But I think overall, I'm glad that these conventions were revelatory about the empty form that is the American political convention. We saw the
go,
form.
Claire, go.
Go for we the saw, jugular, Claire.
No, it's true. I mean, it's true. We saw what it is, which is an infomercial on both sides. And, you know, it was, in some ways, I think people deserve to, as we discussed on previous podcasts, see the way that the parties think of themselves. But ultimately, I'm not sure that they are particularly useful as, you know, what, 8 nights of television viewing for people.
Thanks for joining us. Leave a review and a rating on
I don't get to weigh in.
There was a long pause,
Nate. I think it was boring. Like, it's the headline. It was freaking boring, Trump's speech. It could not pick a theme, which, Mike, as you were saying, is like a little bit interesting given that there's not that much longer to go in the campaign. We're going from like early to late in a hurry here. They're kind of still doing like the grab bag and laundry lists of positive arguments and negative arguments. You know, to Claire's point, they kept kind of circling back. It kind of really feels like when you're walking around some trails or driving around in a city you don't know, where you're like, oh, I remember that 7-Eleven from before. We saw that before, not from the same angle, but we saw that before, and that laundromat and whatever else. Like, I think it was like kind of an almost like inexplicable anti-climax, you know what I mean?
Well, maybe especially compared to 2016, right? Where we had I Am Your Voice, I Alone Can Fix It. It was a very
convention.
I think you're vastly overrating how effective his 2016 speech was, which you got very little convention bounce out of, right? It's just like, there is no reason not to pare this down, right? Because it didn't even like make the same... They were being repetitive. It wasn't even like they just had like a long laundry list. They were saying everything twice. I mean, look, I thought the kind of non-primetime hour was actually pretty good tonight. I thought Alice Johnson was good. I think it's maybe cynical, but probably smart to feature a lot of everyday Americans and non-white speakers. I think the elected officials, except for Nikki Haley and Tim Scott on night one, and Pence was actually fine last night, but they were mostly pretty boring. You know, Tom Cotton, I don't really see that charisma factor of people who think he's a 2024 nominee.
I think before Trump got up to speak, it was the theme that I could generally glom together was America's cities are burning. America's cities are run by Democrats. Democrats are bad for America. Look, all of these people of color are speaking to us about how bad their lives are in Democratic cities. Okay, that was the pre-Trump thing. I think the Trump, like, to go back to the comparison of Trump in 2016 and Trump in 2020, I think that Trump in 2016 was so new and to many people alarming and unconventional that even if, you know, we viewed his 2016 speeches in 2020 and we might think they were kind of like, oh, it's more of the same. When we saw them, like, I remember being in that convention hall in Cleveland and being like, what just happened? That was kind of crazy. He said, I alone can fix this. I remember being struck by that. And tonight, again, it was long, but I think some of it is also we have not tuned out, but it's just become so repetitive, the kind of things that he says, that even if he had like a couple of lines that were like supposed to zing, in part, you know, yes, he should have cut all the chaff around the wheat, but it just, we're used to it. It's lost some of its impact.
There's very little here that you don't see on a daily basis in the president's Twitter feed. Like, I do not think it would have been wise for the president to just have ad-libbed for an hour. It would have been more interesting and had more upside, I suppose, right? But, like, it's just kind of strange. I mean, I think you can compare the conventions. I think one thing Democrats did effectively is, like, they kept things pretty short and tight. You know, they may be a disadvantage because their convention was more virtual than the GOP's. We haven't talked yet, I'm sure we will, everybody, about like the setting at the White House, which is striking in several different meanings of that term, right? But this is not a campaign that is confident about its strategy. I agree with Claire that, like, if you pare it down, then the theme is kind of there are all these Democrat-run cities that are burning and Trump will restore order. There wasn't that much about Biden. There was some stuff, right? But, like, you have to do some work to drill down to that theme. You have to drill some work. I guess if you want to say what attack was the most consistent on Biden, it was more like he's a Trojan horse for Bernie and AOC. But you have to do some work to drill that down.
Let me kind of halfway play devil's advocate here, even though I agree with much of this. So one is, you know, it's hard to write short, as someone who's edited both Claire and Nate.
Oh my God, you went there.
No, I'm kidding.
Oh my God.
No. The speech, I wonder if we're expecting too much from a convention speech. You know, what would the convention speech have looked like that would have been more successful? It would have been more focused. I think you guys are right. It would have been shorter. I think you guys are right. I think the Trump campaign's problem is focused on what? Maybe they would have focused on this, the cities are burning theme. Is that their best line of attack to pursue the rest of this campaign? Maybe they don't know that. And maybe maybe this speech was an exercise in, let's try a bunch of different things, see what sticks, and whatever sticks, that's what we'll grab and carry towards the finish line for the rest of the campaign.
So this was almost like a focus group for the message for the next 2 months.
It was a big focus group. It was a big
elaborate
focus group.
That's why all those people were there on the lawn, not social distancing.
Yeah, so let's mention it was about a 1,900-person event reportedly on the White House lawn. Of course, using the White House as a location in general is norm-breaking, considering that people don't usually use that workspace for the president, the People's House, as a campaign tool. Also,
work from home, Galen. What's that? Work from home.
It is the work from home era. Well, if you're on YouTube, you can see I've clearly broken some norms down here hosting this podcast from my bedroom. But also, you know, we're in the middle of a pandemic. People weren't wearing masks. They were quite closely packed. I questioned early on in the night, you know, if this speech doesn't end up being newsworthy, either for being really good or him saying something highly controversial, is the takeaway from the night that amidst a global pandemic where almost 180,000 Americans have died, the president hosts a near 2,000-person, not socially distanced event on the White House lawn? I guess we'll have to see headlines
well,
tomorrow.
Well, if you put it like that,
but that, but
if you put it like that,
but what other way? Wait, no, I mean, what other way is there to put it? Truly,
I'm being a smartass, okay. But like, I mean, there are two separate things here because they're both arguably important. One is using the White House as a prop in a way that, like, say what you want about Melania Trump's speech on Tuesday and the way they staged that in the Rose Garden, I guess it was, right? But that was, like, fairly tasteful within the bounds of, like, plausible deniability where, like, circumstances force us to use the White House. We're not going to forgo an audience completely, but we'll be discreet and fairly elegant and austere. This was the literal exact opposite of that, right? This was like the literal caricature of when Barack Obama was like trying to roast Trump at the White House Correspondents' Dinner in 2011 and had like the gaudy Trump Hotel sign above the White House, right? It's kind of what it looked like, right? We have these giant Trump Pence signs. You have like literally a fireworks display over the Washington Monument that spells out Trump 2020. It was satire almost. And, you know, I think usually there's like a lot of like media pearl clutching over, oh, the Hatch Act, which you could almost imagine the Trump campaign saying, okay, let's distract from the pandemic. It's killed 180,000 people and the racial protests, whatever else, right? And have all these people writing about the Hatch Act. This has visuals, though, where, like, I don't know how the average swing voter at home is going to feel about this, right?
Because it's connect those threads
jarring.
For all of us. Because
you
tacky?
Think they don't want to see the White House in
because
such a political
it's
circumstance?
It's tacky.
So what you're saying is the Hatch Act doesn't matter to voters, which I probably agree with, even though it should matter in general. But let's set that aside. And we're not lawyers. But you're saying just because of the sheer tackiness. Can I point out that a lot of people might think it's not tacky to Gustibus, right? Like, I mean, you know, people might not like your murder parasite house from which you taped the podcast, but like some people might like it. So.
Yeah, I think, Nate, I think you have this not quite backwards, but like half backwards. I think the Hatch Act is important and is not pearl clutching, although I agree, I don't think voters will care about it. I think the setting on the White House, voters won't care about either. And in fact,
but why? Because it's very dramatic.
Some people like dramatic.
Good. It may be upside for Trump, maybe downside.
I mean,
but
have
like,
you?
Yeah, it looked presidential. Yeah.
If you've been to more than five weddings, you will experience the range, a relative range of human tastes. Things that some people think are tacky, some people think are the greatest thing in the world. Like, I don't think there's no accounting for taste.
But it brings home the notion that Trump is using the White House in a way that is very political. So the sub-theme that only esoteric journalists care about, right? Now you're actually going to test that proposition for better or for worse.
I love how you, when you're trying to undercut my point, you call me an esoteric journalist.
But, okay.
I'm in there too.
So let's just say, we're going to find out what Americans think about it. But Micah, you were going to say something else.
Yeah.
Right.
So I think the actual problem with Trump's address isn't that it was long, isn't that it was at the White House, isn't that it was all over the place. I think it's that Trump and Republicans still do not have a cogent story to tell on the coronavirus. And that's the, by various polls, depending on how you ask, the number one issue in the country. People are still dealing with it at every moment of every day. And they just don't have a story to tell that is politically compelling and bears any resemblance to the truth. And that's a big problem.
And when he talked about it, he was not very... It wasn't an empathetic way of talking about the pandemic. And I think maybe if there's a visual that could make news and could matter, it'll be the lack of social distancing. I'm not sure off the top of my head what protocols were followed, whether or not everyone there was tested, but people weren't wearing masks.
This is outdoors, which is a lot better. Not a lot of masks, which is bad. I think the signal it sends, though, look, okay, maybe I'm going to get myself in a little bit of trouble here with certain people in the audience, right? I'm still kind of mad about the messaging around the protests and public health people being kind of blasé about the fact that you're sending a very different message on social distancing now, where you say this is worth coming together for, and yeah, COVID's important, but we saw social distancing decline in the US after that, and Trump did his own version of it. He had the Tulsa rally at around that time, right? So I don't know. When you have a signal that we're going to pretend like it's all normal, you can not only gather in crowds with a lot of clapping and screaming, you can also not wear masks. And we're not even going to pretend like it's an issue. I mean, apparently they tested people that were like sitting in the immediate orbit of VIPs, but not anyone else, right? I worry that the signal that sends is like, okay, we can forget about COVID again. And now we're just at the point now where cases have come down enough where it feels like, well, things are getting back to normal, right? I think there's some chance that maybe not the rally itself, right? I think people have often been wrong when they've tried to pinpoint exactly how many cases occurred at this or that event, right? But if the signal is now in this back and forth seesaw that, okay, you don't have to, worry as much about social distancing and stuff, that could still send COVID cases up again, which is bad for America and frankly, probably also bad for Trump's reelection campaign, because there is still plenty of time for there to be a third wave. We can debate that vocabulary wave, but another peak or a rise in cases before November.
I agree with that, Nate. I agree with all of that. I guess what I'm also saying, though, not to be just crassly political, but is that, okay, let's say you had not seen any polling data for all of this election, and I just sat you down in front of both conventions, had you watch them, beginning to end. What would you infer from each convention about the state of the race? Would you at all infer that Trump is trailing by a sizable margin nationally and a meaningful margin in many swing states, and that he was trying anything to close that gap? You get what I mean?
But Americans are gonna wake up tomorrow and they're not gonna be able to go to their job if they still have a job. They may not be able to send their kids to school. They may not be able to look forward to their college football season depending on where they live, right? The businesses they rely on, the restaurants they go to may be closed permanently, right? This kind of suspension of disbelief around COVID doesn't really work very well.
I think that's the argument that Mike is making.
That's what I'm arguing. Yeah, and that combined with we know, I think, that the pandemic is having an effect on the election. It helps explain why Trump is trailing pretty meaningfully. And so I guess I'm just surprised, to Claire's point, that Trump didn't at least try a more empathetic route. Or frankly, I thought Ivanka's speech, for example, was pretty effective. She had a couple kind of empathy lines in there, but it wasn't a theme really throughout most of the convention. I'm surprised they didn't try that.
Melania Trump's speech was the most in line with frankly the reality of the country right now, which is, frankly, a pretty sobering reality. I think that's what was out of whack for people in some ways, was that COVID is the thing that drives our culture, that drives our economy, that drives our politics, and the lack of engagement with that reality on most of the themes in the RNC was striking and might strike voters.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, the really daring thing they could have said would be to do some version of like, this is an unprecedented challenge. We made some mistakes. We also did some things well, but now we've turned the corner, right? That's a bold message that is kind of half true.
Or even say, set up, if you're going to set up out on the White House lawn, go set up all of the different vaccines that are being, that are under trial right now. Go talk about all of the things that America,
like
that America has to look forward to. Talk about all the things you're doing, even if it's,
you got the Oxford and the
an
Pfizer
exaggeration and isn't literally you, but pharmaceutical companies, right? Like, why not talk about, these are all of the things we're doing to try to make your life immediately better because we're going to fix COVID. I alone can fix it.
I think you could try what Nate said. I think you could try what Galen said. Honestly, I think you could even just going hard on empathy and admitting to no mistakes. And it's just empathy, empathy, empathy. We're going to build it back. And that would have been better. We're going to build it back better.
I think you just did the Biden campaign.
Well, no, but the Trump campaign should be build back best.
Build back best.
Okay.
Build back great again.
Okay, so I do have a couple questions before we cut ourselves off for the evening. The first one being that in total, the Republican National Convention did not seem completely base driven. It seemed like there were a lot of Black Republicans making appeals to, we aren't just driven by culture wars or racial resentment. In fact, Democrats have made that up. You saw lots of women. You saw what seemed to be appeals to the college-educated white voters that have been a challenge for Republicans over the past 4 years. Nate, you've often criticized Trump as making too many plays to the base. Wasn't this kind of an indication that the campaign they plan to run now, it has maybe broader appeal?
No. I think it was a smart choice for the convention. It's certainly not. I mean, Galen, we have watched this president for 3.5 years now, right? To assume any correlation between strategy on day one and strategy on day one plus N is foolish. I think the convention might be effective precisely because clearly this was not like Trump's strategy, I don't think, right? Some group of people who were like, okay, to do a little bit of more conventional outreach to the center, despite Trump's best instincts or worst instincts, would probably be smart. Precisely because they did that, I think they might get more of a bounce they would otherwise or not. I have no idea. Maybe they'll get an anti-bounce, but maybe they'll get a bounce, right? Do I have any confidence at all that that will be the theme even 3 days from now, even tomorrow? No. So it's like because it's so unorthodox relative to the Trump campaign where they might actually get like some type of dead cat bounce, but like I don't think they're going to pivot. I don't think Trump's going to pivot for the next 70 days or whatever it is. I mean, I think that's pretty unlikely.
Does anyone else have thoughts?
Claire's done with conventions.
I mean, some of it is also just like, what are you supposed to say about some of this stuff? You know, like I think particularly on the lack of COVID acknowledgement or the really, really misleading, if not factual talk about the course of the virus in America. That stuff is surreal. I mean, I've been reflecting that it's been like 5 years since I've been at 538, and it is surreal that this is the presidential election that we're in and that this is the campaign that we're covering. So it is like, yes, I do. Like, yes, we talk about the White House lawn stuff. And yes, I have the thing that it's a TV show. But there is some level of it where it's just really, I kind of can't believe that this is like the convention.
Well, the sheer number of falsehoods during Trump's speech and during the RNC was amazing. Also, I said this on the live blog, but there was this moment where, you know, during the DNC, you saw speaker after speaker after speaker say, Joe's just a decent guy. Like that's the bar, right?
Right.
And then during the RNC, it was like essentially like Trump is not mean, basically. He has shown me kindness. And it feels like
in private moments, yeah.
Yeah, when the camera's off, that is very telling about the moment we're in, that those are the bars, right?
But it's also so, Mike, I mean, that's a perfect way to put it. It's also so emblematic of the utter fruitlessness of these campaigns. I mean, these are systemic problems. They're not just like U.S. systemic problems. They're world health systemic problems. So the fact that we've spent 2 weeks saying like, this guy's a nice guy and this guy's a nice guy in private, it's like, great. So 2 weeks later, it's 12:20 in the early morning, and it's like, there's still how many people dead, and when's the vaccine coming out? And, you know, so on some level, it's just like,
well,
and boom, there it is, right? Like, I don't know.
Yeah. And I think that's another way in which the conventions being mostly virtual and taped actually made them even less useful and meaningful than they typically are. You know, a lot of people were saying, including I think I said, and people on staff were saying, like, the most compelling moments probably of both conventions were moments with actual voters telling their stories. Those were also the most produced and contrived moments, like the most commercial. They're essentially commercials, right? And so if you're trying to just use the convention to learn about the party, to learn about the campaigns, to learn about what the party thinks of itself and its voters, then everything being virtual and taped doesn't help you if you're just trying to learn. I mean, it would have been very, very revealing, I think, to have seen the Trump campaign and the Republican convention respond in real time to the shooting of Jacob Blake and the protests and riots in Kenosha. That didn't happen. Now, do I think, you know, the convention would have been meaningfully different than the pre-taped version? Probably not. You know, I don't think, you know, Republicans fundamentally don't think police killing Black Americans is a systemic problem, right? That's not their position. But anyway, everything being virtual and pre-taped, I do think made both conventions even less meaningful than they typically are, and they're typically not all that meaningful. So,
I mean, there's a real suspension of reality with all the other news going on, ranging from Kenosha to the hurricane to the COVID pandemic to even, you know, the NBA season getting canceled and uncanceled, apparently, based on the latest reporting. So, and the economy, obviously. So again, like, I don't know, part of me has an instinct that, like, Trump might get a bounce out of this because you are suspending disbelief for 8 hours or however many, 10 hours of programming, right? But then, like, kind of you're snapped back to reality, and then maybe it's very ephemeral. It's an awfully confident bet that Americans somehow forget about all this stuff until November, or that things just get kind of objectively better by November, which maybe is possible, but there are a lot of fronts that you're fighting on, right? I don't think they did a ton of defining of Biden, because one of their David versus Goliath strategy for losing is like, okay, just tear your opponent down. You know, there is some evidence that even though Biden didn't get much of a head-to-head poll bump, although there haven't been that many polls, so we still aren't totally sure, his approval ratings did improve, or favorability ratings, Biden did improve a bit, his image improved, so Biden's image was bolstered. I don't think Trump had that coherent an attack to tear it down. One of the issues with this, like, Trojan horse attack is, like, you're kind of conceding that Biden himself is not a bad guy, but he's a Trojan horse for Nancy Pelosi or whatever. That's a non-trivial concession. They tried a little bit of Hunter Biden with Pam Bondi, but that kind of came and went, right? A little bit of Sleepy Joe, he's not up to the job. Kind of Giuliani was saying that, right? But, like, having had trouble landing punches on Biden, that part of it could have been quite a bit more focused.
All right. Well, we will see where all of this takes us in terms of the polling. Of course, we'll be back on Monday with a regular podcast. But as we've mentioned, it's late. It's already Friday. And we will leave things there. So thank you, Nate, Claire, and Micah.
Thanks, Galen.
Bounce or no bounce? Come on. Bounce or no bounce? Really quick.
Bounce.
Bounce.
Small bounce.
Bounce.
I don't know.
I say bounce too.
If he doesn't get a bounce, then he's in trouble.
All right, fair enough.
I'll put it like that.
We'll leave it there. And before we go, make sure to check out 538's store, where you can go get all kinds of 538 merch. We do not yet have plush stuffed animals of Fivey Fox, but maybe someday. That's 538.com/store. My name is Galen Droop. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.